This is a community center in the basement of a church in East London. Kids squeal with delight as they're let loose among toys, balls, beads to string into necklaces. Their moms look on, chatting and sipping tea. Pretty much all the moms are wearing hijabs. Some are recent arrivals in England. Some were born here. One young mother, born in London, parents from Bangladesh, says the months since the Brexit vote have been a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, I think people are feeling a bit scared. They don't know if they're going to be accepted as well. Obviously, there's loads of backlashes and everything, you know, people being called names and stuff. So, yeah.
Did that affect you at all?
No, we didn't affect much, but it was families as well.
She chokes. Her eyes start tearing up. She asks me to stop recording and not to use her name. And then she recounts the names she's been called, the jeers that have been thrown at her since the Brexit vote. At a nearby table sits Linda, born in France to Algerian parents. And then there's Fatima, born in France to Tunisian parents. Fatima says, as a European, she worries what Brexit will mean for her and her kids.
Me, my children is French. I'm French. I'm thinking about after, what happened after. And my children is brown hair. And now I want to stay in this country because I start again from zero in this country. If we go in France, we have to start from zero again. I didn't want to start from zero. It's very hard. Then I don't want my children to feel like me when I come in England.
Linda is more nonchalant. She's got a Gallic shrug, a little swagger.
Me is completely different. I had no feeling whatsoever. I don't mind and I don't care because it's true, yeah, I'm French, but because I've got the citizenship, the right to live here, so it doesn't matter. I can go to France with my passport, without doing a visa, my children as well. There's no problem.
Would you, post-Brexit, once it actually becomes final, would you think about moving back to France?
No, never. I've been there for 22 years now.
Here. And here in Britain.
So it's like I grew up here, I was like 19. If I had to compare living here and living in France, tolerance is better here than there. So whatever happened here, it will be okay. You won't be worse than France.
Britain's been less Islamophobic over time, though that's changed a bit in the past couple of years. As we talk, Fatima's daughter comes up to the table and whispers urgently into her mother's ear. It turns out she wants to hold my microphone. I hand it over to her.
What do you want to say?
What do you want to say?
You want to sing, maybe?
Let it go, let it go. Hit it when we're at the door.
Some things transcend borders and cultures. Frozen is apparently one of them. This is Whose Century Is It? A podcast about ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. I'm Mary Kay Magstead. And this is the second of three episodes I'm doing on the subject of borders, identity, and immigration, inspired in part by the Brexit vote. You've probably heard a lot about the Brexit vote by now, about how disaffected, white, working-class English men and women voted to leave the European Union, slow the influx of immigrants, and make Britain great again, and how urban, educated elites and young people in London and the Southeast, plus the Scots and Northern Irish, wanted to stay in the EU and reap the rewards of being open, tolerant, and cosmopolitan. But as with most things in life, it's more complicated than that. So I sat down with a few people who don't quite fit into these familiar stereotypes, but who do reflect how the Brexit debate and the issues behind it are being absorbed in different ways by different people who are thinking about what their own different layers of identity mean to them. And speaking of layers, so many to peel back in Britain on borders, immigration, and identity. Let's start with Britain's many centuries of expanding outward, creating empire, and ruling the waves.
To Britannia,
probably know of this annual ritual, the last night of the proms at the Royal Albert Hall. But this September, it had a twist. The singer, Peruvian tenor Juan Diego Flores, strode out dressed as the last king of the Incas, in a red and gold robe, a gilded feathered crown, and carrying a ceremonial axe. It was kind of like, I'll see your fallen empire and raise you an even older fallen empire. It was all very postmodern and meta and really quite endearing, even to the BBC announcers.
And a more imperious Rule Britannia I don't think we've ever seen. But that was the last king of the Incas, Juan Diego Flores, singing Rule Britannia 2016 with the BBC Symphony Orchestra and chorus and the BBC singers. And you may have noticed he actually sang it a little higher than usual. He said he thinks it's more exciting, and he's glad he's the first one that's doing it at that pitch. And clearly nobody was going to disagree with him when he's carrying a ceremonial axe. What a star he's been tonight, though. Great earrings, too. I rather like those.
There was a time when all this was taken much more seriously, when a Peruvian dressed as an ancient king at this event would have been committing a grave insult, no matter how well he sang. Because Britain, for a long time, took its age of empire very seriously. It was powerful, it was wealthy, and yeah, it felt a little superior. But then came two world wars. The empire dwindled and declined and morphed into the Commonwealth. There was still the special relationship with the new great power, the United States, and there was a desire to play a role without being subsumed by the emerging European Union. But Britain wasn't what it used to be. That was painful for some. So was the fact that Britain changed from being almost entirely white. Residents from the Commonwealth started showing up. Indian, African, Jamaican, along with other immigrants. And now, about 13% of Britain's population is foreign-born, about the same as in the United States. As in the United States, there's been some resistance to this changing demography, some of it vocal, some of it violent. Mixed in is the fear of who's taking our jobs, who's freeloading off our taxes. Deeper is the question, who are we? Who belongs here? Who are we going to allow in? And how much will we let them change us? Deeper still, some people in Britain, not all, wonder, how did we get from rural Britannia to Brussels telling us what to do?
There's a kind of British exceptionalism, this culture that somehow we simply have more to do with the development of Western civilization than practically anybody else. I mean, the sun never set on our empire.
This is Colin Challen, a former Labour Member of Parliament from Scarborough in Yorkshire, on England's northeastern coast. Many people in Yorkshire voted to leave the EU. Colin voted to stay.
This government is harking back to that kind of thing. I just wonder what their next move is going to be in terms of trying to recreate this old England. I was born in the 50s, and you'd think that there was always blue skies. The roads were never congested. It was a golden age of memory. In actual fact, there was a lot of poverty. Rationing had only just finished. A lot of people romanticised the 1950s, and I think we're now seeing that emerging as part of this anti-EU thing, where we didn't have to bow and scrape in Brussels. We didn't have a bureaucracy that allegedly cost us billions of pounds, created rules that were balmy. We had to have straight bananas or straight cucumbers, or you could think of anything that is positively absurd, and then somebody would say, well, you can blame a Brussels bureaucrat for that.
I met Colin in a park near the banks of the Thames, where tables were full of young Londoners enjoying a warm September evening under a harvest moon. It was kind of idyllic, but Colin wasn't feeling it. Hottest September day in London in 50 years? That worries him. So does the looming Brexit, Britain's exit from the EU, and what he sees as the mindset that led to it.
Most people, when they see the St. George's Cross flag, which is our national flag of England, identify with this little Englander mindset, which was very often racist. It was the British National Party, or UKIP. It was beer guts, lager drinking, obnoxious football fans. That is just one image of the English character, which I detest, frankly. I mean, there are some things that I really love about this country. I don't think I'd want to live anywhere else, but after the Brexit vote, I mean, I think quite a number of people were applying for Irish passports, because if your granddad was Irish, apparently you have the right to get an Irish passport, and their applicants shot up. After Brexit, then I think we're onto a very strange new territory altogether, which is going to be dangerous.
Many people in Britain, almost half, share Colin's concerns. But then there's the other half, a bit more than half, actually, judging from the way the Brexit vote went, who are more concerned about Britain taking back its sovereignty from what they see as the bureaucratic, elitist, ever-expanding European Union. On a different day, in a pub near Parliament that Charles Dickens frequented, or so a plaque here boasts, I met a businesswoman named Sharon Beerer and her 19-year-old daughter, Laura. Both campaigned for Brexit. Laura actually worked closely with United Kingdom Independence Party leader Nigel Farage, though neither she nor her mother are members of the party. And both mother and daughter still get excited when they talk about the moment the BBC announced the way the vote had gone. Here's Laura first.
That was the time I thought we weren't going to win. Actually, it was only when David Dimbleby turned and said, "I can now announce that Brexit have won," and I just went, "What? What are you on about?" And I just completely freaked out and was...
called my son at about 2 o'clock. We called him up and said, "Jacob, you're going to have to come down to this party because I actually think it's just a possibility." And then at 4 o'clock, when it was enough, I'm not kidding, it was one of the most exciting, I think, actually, pretty much the most exciting moment of my life.
And it was when Nigel and Aaron Banks said, "Laura, go get the champagne." I went, "No, I'm not getting the champagne. That's just that's, you know, tempting fate, not happening." They're going, "We're going to the house. We'll meet you in an hour at the lawn." I went, "I'm not getting the champagne." So they sent me off. I had these two massive bottles. I walked out. I went, "Well, this is tempting fate, isn't it?" And they went, "No, we've got it. We've got it." And they took them from me. And I sort of looked at them and I was like, "No, this can't be happening. This isn't happening." And they were going, "It's happening."
Now it's fun. But it for me, I said that day, "I've waited about 30 years to bring democracy back, hoping it would come back." I said, "And if we lose, we're not going to have another vote maybe for 20, well, until the European Union collapses, and that could be 30, 40 years' time, who knows." I said, "And I'll be dead by then." I said, "And I want my country to be free and democratic again before I die." And so it sounds really melodramatic, but I was so excited. I couldn't believe that when they put me 6 feet under, I will actually be buried in democratic soil. I can't tell you how excited I was.
It was a good night.
Now, before you start drawing conclusions about Laura's and Sharon's worldview, consider this from Sharon.
"We happen to be a Jewish Christian Islamic family. My brother is Jewish and he's married to a Pakistani. I've got one sister who's a Muslim. I've got one brother who's a Jew, and I've got one sister who's a Jew, and I'm a Christian. So it's all and he's a Lutheran, he's a Christian of sorts.
And I'm a black sheep and an atheist.
And Jacob's just married a Pentecostal American. So, you know, we're all a bit of a mixture, really. So we've always been brought up in a sort of a somewhat hybrid way."
Laura is also half Danish. Her mom, Sharon, met her Danish husband during anti-EU campaigning in the early 90s. Both Sharon and Laura say they're not anti-immigrant. They just think each country should be able to decide who to let in and how, and to be able to plan ahead. Sharon specifically mentions the 800,000 Polish people now living in Britain. There was a lot of lashing out at that population around the Brexit vote.
"So if you are going to have 1 million Poles come in 5 years, then we need to know so we can plan hospitals, training of doctors, training of dentists, training of school teachers, primary schools. You can't have mass immigration without planning your infrastructure. And I think that's what's been the biggest problem. That is what's caused, of course, all the angst and frustration. So I accept that Southeast England is absolutely packed. I mean, I do get that. But I also know that there are people who need to come, particularly refugees, and I also know that there are people we should have because we need them. I mean, I know that there are people we want to bring in, companies want to bring people in from India, Singapore, America, because they have expertise and, you know, it takes them a year to do it. Well, this is a nonsense.
Actually, there are almost as many Indians in Britain now as there are Poles. There are also a couple hundred thousand Chinese, more than there are Americans in Britain. And yes, there are Europeans, about 2 million, including the Poles, who live and work in the UK. There are also more than 1 million British people who live and work outside their own country in the EU. For people who voted for Brexit, there was some resentment that Europeans could just come in and get jobs, and that there was no way that the UK could necessarily stop Europeans from coming in. But there was an interesting study in the Economic Journal in 2014 that showed that it was actually the non-EU immigrants who were harder to integrate. The study said that they were twice as likely as natives to drop out of secondary school or to be unemployed, and that non-EU immigrants had been a net drag on the UK budget from 1995 to 2011. Integrating can take a generation or more, but in the end they do generally integrate and contribute to society and to the economy. And refugees? Well, they eventually integrate too. Sharon and Laura are all for Britain taking more of them in, just not in the way that Brussels would necessarily like them to do it.
Refugees should not be allowed to come across the Mediterranean. I think Angela Merkel did a great disservice to people. I think refugees should be taken from the refugee camps because those are the ones that don't have the money to be able to pay the people smugglers. The ones that have paid the people smugglers are the ones that have got cash, health, flexibility. The ones that are in the camps are the ones that can't, and they are the people we should be taking. In the campaign, I was very upset when people put refugees with economic migrants.
Two very different things.
And I felt that was quite wrong, because it's one thing not having a job in Romania, and I feel enormous sympathy, but your life is not at risk. If, on the other hand, you're in Aleppo and you're being bombed, your life is at risk. Those two things are separate, and you have to decide as a government and as a people what your priority is. My priority would be people who desperately needed to be safe.
There are now about 120,000 refugees living in the UK, according to the British Red Cross, including a few thousand Syrians. Britain has agreed to take 20,000 over 5 years, and it's just beginning to let them in. Sharon and Laura say they'd be happy to see those numbers rise. So Laura, who's just beginning her university studies in international relations at King's College, gets deeply annoyed when her peers lump her and all pro-Brexiters together as being racist xenophobes.
I've left about 4 or 5 parties I've been to or social events with my friends because I've been so badly attacked about voting for Brexit or working for Nigel Farage or working with him. So badly attacked. Disgusting, you're a vile human being. Oh, that is vile. I mean, nobody talking to me. I mean, it was really bad. The people in my age group were really, well, not even my age group from my sort of type, the school I went to, that kind of thing, they all absolutely couldn't understand it. It was really bad.
Laura acknowledges that some people who voted for Brexit want to keep immigrants out. But she says what resonated for her about Brexit wasn't about keeping foreigners out, but about taking control back from Brussels and letting Britain decide the contours of its own future. I heard the same thing again when I sat down with another pro-Brexiter, Tim Pendry, who runs a public affairs and reputation management consultancy and describes himself as libertarian, democratic socialist, cynic, existentialist, and politically non-Euclidean.
Immigration was heavily exaggerated as an issue. It is a concern, but not for the usual caricature of racist or xenophobic reasons. That just suits the propagandists on the other side. It's much more subtle than that. It's the notion and idea that a nation state grows organically over time and absorbs new ideas and new people at every opportunity, regardless of their race, gender, or whatever. What was happening in practice was that global free markets were drawing in cheap labour to undercut domestic labour. And so there were strong, solid left-wing arguments, if you like, as well as right-wing arguments, for being able to choose ourselves as a people what sort of immigration we would have, at what level, at what pace, how we managed it, how we made it sustainable. The blanket imperial European view was simple free movement of labour to build their superstate. And naturally, and reasonably, people who are poor are going to head to where things are rich. That's fine and good for them, no gripe about them, but it destabilises the heartland. It destabilises those countries that have welfare states and have organically built themselves into social democracies, which is precisely what has happened.
If the European project proceeds as it has been proceeding for a few years now, where it just continues to build more connections and where states give aspects of their sovereignty to the EU, do you think it's unworkable to have a superstate that can still serve its citizens, where citizens can actually have a voice in what's happening in the region?
Yes, in the end, I mean, there is a theoretical model which is much closer to that of the United States, but the United States is flailing around at the moment, and that's an honest truth. But Europe's original model was to be a European Union of states in the American way, only nicer. That was the plan, nicer.
Nicer how?
More social welfare, more social democratic. But it misses out lots of truths, and there's so many of them. Let us just concentrate on a few. One is that mass democracy in itself ends up with huge coalitions of people who must all come from some common interest. And Europe is just too different. Language is one. The differences in basic economies, they have to be brought together in some way. Cultures in terms of their original religious base. Attitudes to very simple things, like we talk about xenophobia. One of the ironies is that individuals in the Nordic countries can actually be instinctively far more racist, in my experience, than can British people. Partly because we had an empire and we were dealing all the time with people from different cultures. So all these differences were turned into this abstract ideal, which, at the end of the day, with no force to bring it together, was done through stealth, through soft power, through half-truths, and through creating an elite that really became extremely disconnected from ordinary people. And now it's all playing out with the migration crisis.
And your feeling is that it's unworkable because there are too many different cultures and different languages? Or it's too big, or both?
Well, the linguistic issue can be dealt with over time by the fact that everybody ends up speaking English. The real argument against it is the argument against all empires, in the end. And that is that they end up being run by quite tight and small elites, because they're not responsive to ordinary people at the grassroots.
Can I just pause to say it's interesting to hear an argument against empires from a citizen of the country that created one of the biggest empires in human history? As our conversation went on, I asked him if, by having governance that was more responsive to people at the grassroots level, he now wanted Britain to have regular referenda on specific issues, like California does. And he said, no, not necessarily. Only on existential issues, like whether to cede sovereignty to a group like the EU. What matters most to him post-Brexit?
We have sovereignty returned to us.
But in which aspects is that most important to you?
Well, by the fact that the buck stops with the Crown, the government, the Parliament. The buck stops with them. Things can't be referred on to something outside our country.
Right, but specifically, like, is it concerns related to regulation, related to immigration, related to border controls, related to something else?
They're not concerns about any of those in the sense that it's for us to decide as a nation what we want in a sovereign way. So, for example, were we to decide to have just an open borders, that's our decision. It's our decision. It's not the European Union's decision. It's our decision. So it may be that it turns out that they have closed borders and we have open borders. It doesn't bother me, so long as it's democratically arrived at within the sovereign nation. Very unfashionable, but that's what it is.
The argument is that Europe is holding Britain back from being its best dynamic, entrepreneurial, innovative self. Untethered from Brussels, many pro-Brexiters say, Britain will have new and better economic opportunities in the wider world, and Britain will thrive. Or this could cost Britain. London as a financial center may lose clout. Those who voted against Brexit worry that it will make Britain a backwater. And on this, Tim is interestingly equivocal.
Now what you have is a series of ministers who are committed to international trade. They're committed to survival, national survival. Whether we do it or not, we may fail. But it means that there's a great sense of independence, sovereign independence, which doesn't mean that there isn't a good relationship with the United States of America. Quite the contrary.
But when you say we may fail, you mean on national survival we may fail?
Well, in the sense that if we don't trade and we don't produce, then our economy will decline. Mm. We have a very large and expensive welfare state, and bit by bit that will be cut back, and that will create social tensions. And those social tensions might be expressed as our Celtic areas wanting to find ways out, social division and so forth. So we might not survive in that sense. We might become a declining mid-sized nation, which has got filled with unhappy people, as opposed to being a higher-end mid-sized nation, if you like, that's prosperous and closer to what we think we should be, you know, which is a country with a decent welfare state and a reasonably happy people who are all in employment. It's not that Europe wouldn't have provided that. It's just that I don't think it was about economics ever, in any case. It's not necessarily that Europe wouldn't have provided that, but it's going to provide it under terms in which we're in control. And that's the key thing, being in control.
But will Britain now be in control? Maybe not as much as Brexiters hope or expect, says Colin Challen, the former Labour MP.
We are going to discover that we aren't really leaving the EU, not with a nice clean cut. We're going to be leaving some of the institutions of the EU where we lose our influence. But as in the case of Norway and Switzerland, we will discover that what the EU wants, it has the strong hand. So if you want a trade agreement, or in the case of Norway, quite a number of other access points to the single market, you will have to agree to a great many of the requirements, for example, free movement of people and workers, in order to get those agreements. So even the day after the result was declared, we found that people like Boris Johnson and others were backtracking immediately on issues of free movement and immigration, on issues of real control. I think some of my friends who supported Brexit, who I credit with a great deal of analysis and so on, looking at this issue in perhaps a more historical context, I don't think they were enamoured by some of the arguments that the Brexiters actually used. But I wonder where they're going to be left if they thought that this vision of being a nation state could somehow defend us against the power of multinational corporations, who will still wield influence in Brussels and they'll still wield influence in Whitehall. People in a year or two's time are going to be somewhat confused that what they thought was winning back control simply didn't happen.
And that's not even going into the cost of stepping back from the EU to claim that control. There may be economic costs, opportunity costs. There's certainly already a cost in terms of how the rest of the region sees Britain. Colin is concerned about the signal Britain sends by stepping back from a group that started as a way to bring lasting peace to Europe.
We can see the direction of travel is that nation states will become more defensive, which is one reason I wanted to stay in the European Union, because it is of such a size and its philosophy, I think, was still progress and the defence of European values at their best, not the ones at their worst, which we can easily point back in time to. And I think leaving the European Union, to me, is like abandoning idealism.
And Colin thinks it's a bad time to be doing that, given the challenges facing Britain and Europe in this century. Aging populations, slowing economies, and climate change pressures in other parts of the world that are, among other factors, sparking conflict and driving migration. You could certainly make an argument that global problems need global solutions, and international organizations and regional groupings can help get there. But it's also possible that the challenges of this century won't easily find consensus or compromise at an international level, but can at the local level. In fact, Colin says when he was in Parliament for most of the first decade of this century, that possibility came up in scenario planning about what the century might bring.
And one of the thoughts that occurred to some people in government when I was still in Parliament, just civil servants tossing around scenarios, what might happen in, say, 2050. They're looking at more of a return to, this is just one scenario, more to a kind of medieval practice where cities were walled, where you had city-states, not nation-states, competing with each other. I think, you know, not by 2050, but before then, you will find that nation-states will be thinking more and more about how do we keep them out. Some of the language that's used, like, we don't want to be swamped. Here, at the moment, it's only Brexit. In the United States, it's the Mexican wall. In Palestine, Israel, there already is a wall, which, yes, it's a security wall, but it keeps them out. The other is kept out. Walls are going up in quite a number of places.
Funny thing, I lived for many years in a country known for its wall, the Great Wall. It was built over many years and cost many lives, some say hundreds of thousands of lives. But in the end, the wall was only as strong as its weakest link. Manchus bribed a border guard and swept into power, sweeping out the Ming Dynasty that had tried so hard to preserve what it had to keep the barbarians out. China was never stronger or more culturally vibrant than when it was open, first with the Silk Road, and more recently with the reform and opening up era, stifled of late by China's current leaders, who are also interested in control. On the other hand, as part of my reporting in Asia, I went to Bhutan, which was struggling with the many Nepalese who had come in across a pretty open border over the course of a few decades, and the Bhutanese hadn't even really noticed until the Nepalese migrants, very few of whom had gone through immigration procedures, were saying they wanted citizenship, they wanted the right to vote. And when the Bhutanese saw, oh, wait a minute, they're almost in a majority, they kicked a bunch of these migrants out, they tightened their borders, and they came up with new laws. Clearly, each nation has to figure it out for themselves, and neither a wide-open border nor a completely closed border is necessarily the answer. And Britain, of course, is somewhere in the middle. For all the defensiveness and all the jingoism, the population of London, one of the world's most vibrant cities, is almost 40% foreign-born. So, remember the community center in East London where the little girl was singing Let It Go? One of the volunteers here is a Turkish artist named Ahmet from Istanbul, a native of one of the most cosmopolitan cities in ancient history, living in one of the most cosmopolitan cities of our age. As he helps the kids string beads into necklaces, he says, this is home now. This is part of who he is.
Quite happy here because I've been so long in this country, since 1972, so a long time. So I studied here and I get used to it because I live more than my country.
And this is all true at the same time. Ahmed's experience and that of the London-born Muslim woman sitting just a few feet away from him, who teared up talking about the names she'd been called since the Brexit vote. And then there are the various and sometimes conflicting desires of different Brexit supporters and the many other Britons who worry about what will happen as Britain steps away from the grand European experiment. As the Irish poet once said, things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Or maybe it can, depending on what you're calling the center. Is it determined by national borders, a shared ethnicity, a shared agreement to live together as a tolerant society, however big or small? The challenge for Britain, and for that matter, for the United States and for the EU, is that there is no clear agreement about what the center is, or was, or should be, and where the path forward should lead. Britain's gotten through bigger challenges, and I suspect it'll figure this one out too. And so will the European Union. But I'm also guessing, whatever happens, neither will be quite the same again. That's it for this time. Comments, suggestions? Send me a note at whosecentury@gmail.com or on Twitter. I'm at Mary Kay Magstad, that's MaryKayMagistad, all one word. You can read more about this topic and see photos and links on our webpage, pri.org/century, where you'll also find all our previous episodes. We're also on SoundCloud and Stitcher and most podcast apps. Go ahead, just punch in Whose Century Is It? And hit subscribe. And if you like the podcast, please rate it and review it. It helps others find it. Next up, a tale of two countries that have had their own ordeals with borders and belonging, the lands of my ancestors, Ireland and Germany. If you missed the first part of this trio of episodes, check that one out too. It's one very well-spoken global citizen's case for more open borders and more tolerance within them. Whose Century Is It is a co-production between me and PRI's The World in cooperation with WGBH and the BBC World Service. It's funded by a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation. Thanks for listening. Join us next time.